Hello, everyone. Welcome to Laser Focus. This is the deep dive pop culture podcast from Nerdist. I'm Kyle Anderson. Thank you so much for joining us. I am thrilled to be joined this week by someone I've admired. Someone whose work I have admired, there we go, sentence structure, for a good long while. He is one of the best video essayists on the internet. You've probably seen a million of his videos. Welcome to the show, Patrick H. Willems. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. You can find Patrick's, we'll do the plugs at the end, but you can find Patrick's videos on YouTube and on Nebula, which is a creator-owned streaming service of video essay goodness, which I highly recommend. I'm not being sponsored. That's just a thing I enjoy. thanks for coming. And I want to first say, I really liked your most recent Star Wars video, your holiday special. I thought it was a lot of fun.
Thank you very much. We had a lot of fun making it. For those who are listening and haven't seen it, we made a really... I like to proudly say I think it's the dumbest thing Nebula has ever funded. a 1960s style like TV Christmas special that we like built a set for and everything that also doubles as a video essay about Star Wars. Because I decided after years ago swearing off ever publicly talking about Star Wars again, I agreed under the one condition that it would be behind a paywall with no comments section. And so that's the only way I'll ever do it now.
Sorry, I'm doing an in-person comment section for your video.
Oh, that is quite all right.
That was like your last Star Wars video was what, right at the tail end of 2019. And then obviously the world exploded thereafter. So that was like a very strange time. It feels really like a line of demarcation of your content. Your videos, not content. We're not allowed to say that.
I always laugh when people like catch themselves mid-sentence saying the word content.
I don't like it either, but it's just something you have to say now.
It's just very funny because if anyone wants to like say anything about my work and call it content, I'm not going to get mad.
Right.
It's just when you make a whole video with like about why you hate one word, it's funny when people suddenly like... You know, feel like this happens to me sometimes if like I'm just like talking to random people and they'll just be like, you know, hey, I've been watching your content for you. Oh my God. And they start apologizing and they feel really bad. And I was like, I don't mind. Genuinely, I like that you've been watching it, whatever you call it. But it's funny. The last Star Wars video I made, I think it came out in like February 2020.
Yeah.
Like it might have been the last video I shot before I'd heard the word coronavirus.
Mm-hmm.
And it was weird because that was a video that shot like all over New York. It was like a video that could not, there was no way I could make that. Like, starting a few weeks later where it was just me, like a video where it just like involving me walking all through the city. And it was a good time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I got to say, a multi-year break from talking about Star Wars publicly was wonderful.
I'm not even going to cut this out, everyone. You're getting something. I wish I could take a multi-year break from talking about Star Wars sometimes. It's at least we had Andor. I feel like that kind of rejuvenated me a little bit, as you mentioned in your video. But
I will say, I'm catching myself. I did a whole podcast about Andor with David Chen. We did an episode by episode podcast covering that show. So I did actually publicly talk about Star Wars.
But that's part of the, story. It's part of the mythos of you that you don't talk about Star Wars.
It wasn't a video.
Yep.
That's true. And again, no comment section.
Yeah. also good. Obviously Patrick is a font of knowledge and opinions about all sorts of film and television and comics, but we're here to specifically this week to talk about comics. Junji Ito manga, but I do want to ask you what I know you are a big comics guy. What sort of comics are you reading now, like either new or kind of collected stuff you're picking up?
Okay. Big question.
Yeah, I know it's huge.
Let me dive in. I will say about an hour ago, I read the latest issue of Wonder Woman the new series by Tom King and Daniel Semper, which I think is really good so far. I think this was issue 5. I think it's been a really strong run, and I'm really excited to see where it goes, because it seems like they have a plan for just like to do this for several years. In terms of comics right now, I'm one of these people who does go to the comic book store every week, and I pick up my pull list and I got all my books, and I often think I'm probably reading too many books, because I am drawing, I always draw a blank on like what are the ones that I'm like into right now, even though I've got a whole stack of these things that I'm like, you know, that I read every single week. Oh my God. I will say I am currently, in terms of like non-current comics, that was a fun sentence.
Uncurrent, yes.
I am reading through Akira for the first time in full.
Oh boy.
Yeah, for some reason, I bought and read the first two volumes when I was in high school. And then I think just because I was a broke high school student, I never got the rest of it. And then a couple of years ago, I was just like, I think because of people who would like see like my shelves of graphic novels, like just in the backgrounds of videos, and they'd be like, why do you only have two volumes of Akira? And I'd be like, right. Yeah, this is embarrassing. I'm gonna fix that. So I bought all the rest, and now I'm finally reading the whole thing straight through. I'm about halfway through, and here's a scorching hot take: Akira is very good.
Oh,
it's
boy.
It's a good comic. so I'm really enjoying that. This it's killing me trying to remember what else in terms of like current monthly comics I'm really enjoying.
Well, let me throw this out to you. I know you're an X-Men guy. Are you reading the current run of X-Men stuff?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Yes. It's so good. I love it to pieces. I'm going to be very sad in a couple months when it ends.
I know. Okay. I'm happy to hear you say that, because I know, even though obviously the Hickman or Krakoa era was like a huge deal, especially like when it started and, you know, it sold so much and like obviously made the X-Men books better than and just more exciting than they'd been in years, maybe decades.
It's possible. Like, you'd have to really like, I know you're a big fan of New X-Men, as am I, the Grant Morrison run. I think only a couple after that it stopped being really good, in my opinion. But like, not unreadable, but just like to the level that it was. It seemed like it was just really content on doing all the same stuff it had always done.
Right. I hadn't even really followed X-Books for several years before that. I mean, I think the last one that I remember really enjoying and reading like in full was Jason Aaron's Wolverine and the X-Men.
Which is great. Yes, absolutely.
Which is great. And I that was also like, was that around the time that Bendis took... kind of,
I think so. What was that? 20 something? I can look that up.
Because like Wolverine had the school, and then Bendis was doing Cyclops' book, where Uncanny, where Cyclops was basically a terrorist, and then there was All New X-Men, where the teen original ones came back. Anyway, there was that era. But look, this is a tangent. Basically, the point of this is I have enjoyed the Hickman and Krakoa era so much, and I know some people have, you know, I feel like over the past, maybe like since Hickman did like Inferno and kind of moved away, have been like, look, let's get this thing wrapped up and move on to the next era. And I've just been like, I don't know, the whole Fall of X thing, the most recent Hellfire Gala has like once again radically changed up the status quo. I think things have been really exciting since then, and now we're basically in the home stretch, and it's just like, look, it's the whole thing with comics, with mainstream superhero comics, where obviously we all know the illusion of change concept, and there's always kind of the feeling that like, okay, there might be like incremental evolutions or adjustments, maybe a character will die, maybe a supporting character will like get married, or like someone will become a villain or whatever, but usually things are gonna, you know, be really recognizable and stay how we're used to. And it's been so fun just seeing the X-Men books now for several years, just, I mean, like, I'm sure they'll have some kind of reset eventually, mm-hmm. but it really seems like they have zero intention of ever, like, resetting to, like, a regular status quo and are just going forward without looking back, just, like, so relentlessly. And where they are right now, I think I have a couple new issues that I haven't read yet, but I think it's been a blast.
Yeah, it's truly, like, you know, from House of X and Powers of 10, which was just kind of like a mind-blowing sort of revelation about, like, all the X-Men stuff you've read for years actually did happen within the context of all that. It was just like, oh, that's really cool. That's what a great idea. And then, yeah, making them the kings of the world for a good period of time and then having like the crushing defeat and now them being kind of fugitives again. I think it's just like, it's a really great full circle kind of thing. The one thing I am worried about, and I don't think they'll do it. I hope they'll do what you say, is that because there is a reboot, literal time reboot kind of mechanic built into this era, that they'll just completely literally reset it to what it was before. Because I think that will undo so much really great character development and sort of like, but the thing that makes me think they won't do that is because then they would have to reboot the entire Marvel universe, and I'm not sure they want to do that.
Yeah, I really have no clear idea about like what might happen at the end of all of this, because like as you said, they do have a mechanic like built in there where they can just wipe it all away. But also, I feel like no one would be happy at all with that. The idea of losing all of that progress, but it's also just the funny thing because, you know, during this era, even though they'll occasionally, you know, like Emma Frost will like marry Tony Stark or whatever, but like it's been, the X-Books have been like so self-contained and just in their own little universe that, you know, whatever they do at the end of this or like blow it all up, it's not going to affect the rest of the Marvel universe that much.
Yeah.
It'll pretty much just be an X thing. But yeah, I mean, my big question is just like, who follows this? What, like, you know, who is the writer out there who can, who might seem as exciting as like when Hickman came in, you know, for some bold new era? Like, all I can imagine is that it's going to be something. And, you know, we've already seen like the tease of the logo, which is, looks more like the original classic logo, not the 60s Kirby logo, the one we all think of. Yes, the one was it Neil Adams who designed that logo?
Maybe. I think so. I think you're right.
But yeah. like I could only assume that they're kind of gonna play some of the hits and be like, they're back in Westchester.
Yeah.
The building is there. We're going to go in a more superhero direction. Honestly, kind of like, and I did, like, I remember, like, you know, loving this run, like, when I was in high school. But you know, when Astonishing came out with Whedon and Cassidy, and that was a thing where it was like, look, we're going to do a kind of a more traditional superhero thing. And, you know, and like within universe, that made sense because, you know, I feel like in that first issue, Cyclops is like, look, we kind of have to like win back over the public again and be like superheroes. And it wouldn't surprise me if they straight up having him say the same thing again, like after the Krakoa era.
I could see that. I think that would be, I mean, because they're, you know, their PR is very bad at the moment.
Not great. Wait, yeah. I mean, here's a question for you. Do you have any ideas, like, you know, just like, you know, if you were editor in chief of Marvel, who would you like to, who do you pick to come in and like revamp the X-Men? Because for years, I always was just like, look, the only thing that would get me excited about X-Men again is if they got Hickman to come in and give him like, you know, a blank check. And that's what they did. And so after this, I'm just like, I have no other ideas.
Well, I know so many people were really worried about when Hickman left and Jerry Duggan took over, but I think like Duggan's Marauders was so good that I was like, and also he's kind of steeped in the X-Men universe. He's written,
and then also, you know, bring in Kieran Gillen and Al Ewing as like, you know, the other main guys. I'm just like, yeah, those are the guys you get.
I think Gillen, I mean, I don't know if he would. I don't know if anybody from the Krakoa era is going to continue on. Like Ben Percy's wrapping up his X-Force and Wolverine runs and everything like that. They're not continuing on with anybody as far as I know. But that's a really good question because a lot of my very favorite writers in comics right now have written in the Krakoa era. Like, and a lot of them now have, like, from the early part have kind of jumped ship and gone to DC for other books. I know it's all freelance. It's not as big as it was when Kirby went to DC or anything like that. But Tom King seems very steeped in DC right at the moment. Like, I think they're not going to let him go. You know how big a news it was when Bendis went over to DC for Superman and how, And that is actually what turned me off of those books, because I was really enjoying the Superman book, Peter Tomasi's book. And then I was just like, ugh. So I would love it if somebody just has a fresh idea, and maybe it's somebody I don't know that well. Right. That's actually what I would like, because like we've done the superstar thing and they've gotten people excited about X-Men again. And as long as they don't completely gut it, you know, the character development, because they've gone through too much, I think, to just go all the way back. But you can do that again. Like, you can maybe pare it down, you know, back to like just X-Men and maybe a couple other like offshoot books. But
right. I mean, it kind of is the nice thing about X-Men where they and this also, you know, is part of the reason that I've never cared much about like the X-Men joining the MCU.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah. Because like, you know, all of the great X-Men stories, all the great X-Men runs have them pretty much just in their own little universe within the universe, dealing with like, because like their cast is so enormous. They have an entire, you know, race of people that you can just do your own thing there and basically not worry about the rest of the Marvel universe. But yeah, it's the thing where I just wonder, like, are they like, is the move to do find some like up and coming super talented person to kind of, you know, be the new head of X and spearhead this, someone that like I'm not really familiar with, because just like looking at the current landscape of writers, I don't know who the superstar is that would get people excited enough. I mean, like Tom King is the one guy who's has like, you know, is enough of a name where people would like really pay attention to that. And again, I just mentioned he's five issues into a Wonder Woman run that he's like talking about doing for years. He's not devote all of his attention to the X-Men now.
No. Yeah. I mean, that would be kind of earth shattering. It's sort of like I was the same thing with like, what two characters would you like to see team up? It's almost the same as like, what writer and artist would I like to see team up? It's like, I mean, I could just say anything and it would be great, but like,
yeah. Hey, maybe they'll go back to like the 2000s move that Marvel loved, where it's like, let's get someone big from Hollywood.
Oh yeah,
I don't think that will.
No, I don't think so either.
And but that was in like the Quesada era. That was kind of the move that they loved doing. And then I feel like ever since Kevin Smith wrote that one issue of Daredevil, and then Jon Favreau wrote those two issues of Iron Man, and nothing else ever came out, then they were like, maybe this isn't the thing to do.
It seems like they might be busy with other stuff.
Yeah, that pays a lot more.
Yeah. I'm just like, I won't say I'm like worried about the end, but like, it's definitely gearing up to the end of that run. And I would love to see. And to your point about the MCU, I think they could really do a great job with like adapting the Krakoa era to film, because, or at least television or something like that, if you're going to do multi-stories, because there's so much going on. And at this point, I think they're banking on everybody having seen the X-Men movies, because, you know, they're bringing all the X-Men back for Daredevil 3 and possibly beyond. You know, spoilers if you haven't watched The Marvels, which statistically a lot of you didn't.
I haven't.
You haven't? Well, do you want me to spoil the end credits of Marvels?
Actually, don't, because okay, it is
happy not to.
All of my friends have been like genuinely very impressed about the fact that without even trying to avoid spoilers, I just haven't heard what it is.
Oh, wow. Well, there we go. Well, I won't be the one.
I have not muted any words on Twitter or anything. I have gone to no effort other than when people like you ask, I say, nah, I'll see it. And yeah. I'll find out. Well, anyway, I think there's an X-Men thing about that. based on context that, clues. But... okay. I figured it was something like that.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, apologies. But it's sort of like that does seem to be like, you know, they're kind of pushing pause on a lot of those things, and they're kind of, I mean, the X-Men is the big thing. They haven't, you know, they did all the Sony Spider-Man crossovers. It's like, now you got to do the X-Men crossover and then reboot it. That seems to be like what they need to do in order to make people care again. They need to do what comics did 20 years ago.
Right. I mean, part of the reason that I've never been that excited about, you know, like, I mean, like, I remember when the Fox acquisition happened, and obviously I just think that was, you know, bad for film, bad for everything. But, you know, at the time, so much of the attitude among this like nerd circles was like, oh, but now we finally get to see Spider-Man and Wolverine on screen together, and we get to see the X-Men done well. And now we skip ahead several years, and people aren't quite as excited about Marvel as they used to be. But even beyond just like the industry aspect of it all, my whole thing that I just wondered about, like, you know, because it's just in terms of introducing mutants and the X-Men now into that story, it seems so like it's such a storytelling challenge, because it's like if they discover mutants suddenly, just like, mm-hmm. like this thing that you know, no one knew about before, that I'm like, so are we just going to go through the same beats from like the Singer movies, where, you know, we see people in you know, we see senators proposing bills and people discovering mutants and the same we've been through too much of that. It's crazy that the Fox X-Men movies just like never seem to want to move beyond the like very initial like mutants are discovered and there's bigotry kind of thing. When it's like, no, what the audience actually wants to see are like people going into space and going to the savage land and like 100-foot tall sentinels walking through the streets and actual, you know, like the crazy shit.
Yeah.
And you need, like, with X-Men and mutants in general, you need to get through so much to get there. So this is why the idea, and this I did not come up with this idea. Did I hear this from my friend Connor Goldsmith from the Cerebro podcast? Maybe it was him, but just the idea of like, do they just straight up come from like a separate universe where like, yeah, Krakoa is already a thing and they're a fully functioning society?
I think that is the way you have to do it. And, you know, if they're gearing up for Secret Wars, that's a great time to just kind of blow the whole thing up and just be like, mutants have been here forever. And now all the stuff that you saw is happened, but now it's with different actors or whatever. I think there's a very good chance that that's going to happen, but mostly because, like you said, we've done all that stuff already. I've had some friends be like, well, no, when they go in the MCU, when they restart it, it has to be the original five. And it's like, that's so boring. That's so not like what anybody wants to see anymore. Like, because there are so many characters, enough to have its own movie universe completely divorced from the main Marvel universe. I always thought that it would be a bad idea for them to join the MCU. And I know that, yeah, like corporate synergy was like against me at that, but like, the metaphor of the mutants doesn't work.
So they can do like everybody's favorite story, Avengers versus X-Men.
Yeah. Oh boy. Everybody loved that one.
Yeah. What's the point? Honestly, I would be so much more interested if they just announced we're going to make new X-Men movies and they're going to be in their own contained universe that will not interact with the MCU. And because like who needs it? I mean, yeah, other than like the, I don't know. Yeah, it might be fun to see. I'm trying to think like,
Well, the one that I always hear is Wolverine fighting Hulk finally. And it's like, that is of so little interest to me that
Yeah,
like,
because
I know
other
that
than,
was literally the first time he appeared, but other than that, like he's right, so much more
cool.
interesting
you,
than
we
that.
We can have one shot where it goes into slow motion and Wolverine right. Recreates the pose from what's it like Hulk 181?
Something like that.
So, and then, you know, like all the nerds in the audience will do the Leo point at the screen.
Right.
And, but yeah, like, yes, the Hulk, famously Wolverine's nemesis.
Right. It's a very, I don't know, there's all sorts of things that, you know, I as an X-Men fan, I'm looking forward to seeing X-Men more, but the more I think about it and the fact that they're rebooting the X-Men cartoon and having it be X-Men 97. It's like so much has happened since then in the X-Men universe. That's way more interesting than what was going on in the 90s. Like aesthetically, that is always part of my heart. Cause that's what I grew up with, was that kind of, you know, Liefeld, Jim Lee look, but right. like, storytelling wise, so much more interesting stuff happened. And that's why it's kind of cool that James Gunn with taking over DC is like, pointing to all these like much later comics, like, hey, we're going to do a lot of Grant Morrison adaptations. Like, great. Give us Grant Morrison.
When he like did that presentation and then it was also like, here are the comics that are like the main, like my main reference points. I'm just like, is this pitched directly at me?
Right. Like I'm going to win over Patrick.
Yeah. Did you hear that like he's been getting a little bit exhausted of superhero movies? The thing that he, you know, like, you know, many years ago said that was like all he wanted in the world. And now you were like doing the exact moves to like get him excited again. Whether like being like, yes, Alan Moore's Swamp Thing and, yep. And Morrison's Batman and all these things. Yeah. That like, because again, a lot has happened since the 90s and like straight up. The thing that would instantly get me excited about an X-Men movie is if they just said the villain is Cassandra Nova. Like the
speaking
like,
of the Cerebro podcast, go listen exactly. to your episode of that.
Yep. That is because look, I will never forget being 12 years old, maybe 12 or 13 years old.
When did that come out? 2001?
Yeah. 2001. Yeah. It was one of those weird things because in 115, Morrison Quietly's second issue, when they destroy Genosha at the end, and it was the weird thing where its imagery really, really similar to 9/11, and it came out like 2 months before 9/11.
Yeah.
It was like summer 2001, and I'm like 13, and picking up New X-Men 114 was maybe the single most mind-blowing comic book reading experience of my life, because it gets to it so fast. Mm. Just like, it is such a radical change right away. And it is Morrison being accessible enough that a 13-year-old can, you know, still get everything. That like imprinted itself in my brain. And if they did that on screen, that
you heard
would
it.
Be cool.
Come on, Feige. Give us Nova.
Yeah, get like...
And Zorn. We want Zorn also.
Oh my God, I want to see Zorn. But yeah, I don't know. Get some like wrinkly 80-year-old woman and make her your big villain. Don't stop worrying about Kang, a character who honestly, even in the comics, I don't think is that interesting.
No.
And you want to go like an old bald lady. That's how you get the fans excited again.
Boy, I tell you, I've mentioned it on the show before, but I did so much research into Kang, and I read so many comics, and they are just absolutely going to just abandon it, which is fine, because I don't actually think he's a great character, but so complicated, that character. And then I was like, okay, let's figure this out. I read so much Steve Englehart stuff from the 70s, and it was
so much of that... So much old Avengers stuff is like a big blind spot for me. Like
me too before that. Absolutely.
Yeah. I had never read an Avengers comic, I think, until Bendis took over with Avengers Disassembled. Mm. Still to this day, like all that Englehart stuff, I just have not read. Because like Englehart is one of my favorite Batman writers.
Yeah. And his Man Thing is like, I mean, there is no, that's Steve Gerber. too many Steves in comics.
A lot of Steves.
A lot of Steves. Anyway, he's great. I agree with you on his Batman run.
Yeah. But yeah, as far as Kang goes, I mostly know him from Avengers Forever. And, you know, a really fun comic that's also like a good entry point because it like to like teach you about Avengers history. But I'm still just like, okay, Kang is not the most interesting part of this. No. I do not look at this guy and say, yes, he is the one that you base the next like decade of storytelling around. He does not have, you know, the clear like hook and motivations of like Thanos.
No.
And so, yeah, I mean, it's a, like, so I'm really hoping, and I say this as someone who straight up just did not see two of the Marvel Studios movies from this past year. I'm just like, look, I really hope they do not decide to just recast the role and carry on with their plan. Don't make John David Washington like right. play that role. Just pick a different character.
Yeah, I don't think anybody was all that excited about Kang, so I think like this is your chance to just wash your hands of it and move on.
Yeah.
Well, we could keep talking about this stuff, but we actually have other things to talk about. I'll save my question about Robin in movies for a different time. We're talking
question.
About. It's a huge question. We're talking, of course, about Junji Ito, who is a manga artist and writer who has been working for 30 some years, like 35, maybe almost 40 years, doing the best horror comics that have ever been made. Almost like, I mean, it's amazing. And like, I feel like his popularity here in the US has only skyrocketed in the last like 5-6 years. Maybe more than that. I don't know. I don't want to shortchange him, but both of us are huge fans of his. And so we're going to kind of dive into that. And all of these things we're going to talk about, we might spoil some of them, but I don't think you can actually spoil the experience of reading them, even if we tell you what happens in them. So, but if there's anything that you don't want to be spoiled on, skip ahead, you know, whatever. If there's any particular thing you don't want to be spoiled on, but we are going to talk a lot about his shorts and then also his like longer novels as well.
Of course. Yeah. Now that I think of it, it seems especially hard to spoil Junji Ito in an audio medium.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, like, I am a very big fan of the guy, and with a few notable exceptions, I can barely name any characters.
No.
In these comics, they are not about their like, you know, big plot twists. They so much of them are about building to just like a reveal of a visual.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, without the visuals here, what are we going to spoil?
And maybe this is better served later in the conversation, but I have a theory or a hypothesis, I guess, that Junji Ito's type of horror only works in page form. I don't think, because there's been a few anime adaptations and there's been a couple live action adaptations too. And I don't think any of them have been, any of the ones I've seen anyway, have done justice to the kind of visceral, like gut-wrenching, like revulsion you can feel and that's the other thing. It's you turn the page and then you see the thing. The last panel of the page before is always somebody looking at something horrifying. And so you know what it's going to be, and you could just shut the book if you wanted to, but you go, I got to see what it is. And it's always horrible. And I think you lose all of that if someone else is directing it and making you watch it. And I think it is an interactive storytelling medium in a way that I don't think we ever think about books as being such.
That is a really good point, because I have never actually watched any of the adaptations of his work. Not that there are all that many.
No.
The main one that I know some friends of mine like, but also I think these friends have not read the comic it's based on, but there are people who like the Uzumaki movie.
Mm-hmm. Which is from like 2000, maybe 2001 or something like that. It's early 2000s.
And it's a live action movie. And whenever I just like even look at the poster and I'm just like, I don't get what the point is or like what you do with that.
Yeah.
And like there, I don't see any reality where it even comes close to capturing the experience of the comic. And I had never thought of it in the way that you just put it about the page turn. And I think you hit it dead on. It's so essential because I feel like what I love about, one of many, many things I love about the comics is that the way they're drawn is usually a pretty normal, like semi-detailed style. And then when you hit that point when a character sees something and you turn the page, and then there'll be this page where he uses like quadruple the amount of ink as he had on the previous page, and the detail ramps up to such horrifying degrees where like there it's like sometimes I'm thinking of some specifically if you know the haunted house stories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, where it's like almost the entire page is like coated in black ink and there's barely any like white left. And just the visual shift from like the regular look to like the hyper, hyper detailed like horror reveal look. There's no way that you could capture that on screen or honestly, really, I think in animation, it would be much harder.
There's been a few... like I think Netflix and maybe Crunchyroll have different collections that people have like animated and they try to replicate the style. But like you said, like they try to make it slightly more realistic all the time. And so when you get to the big reveal, it's not quite as like the detail popping out is not as actually what I think would work. And maybe, you know, they wouldn't obviously do this is you remember the, remember in Ren and Stimpy where there would be like the paintings of horrifying things that they would like pan down? I think that's the only way you can really do it because it's you need to be disgusted and horrified by just an image, which is hard to do in a moving medium, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. And it's funny because that thing on Ren and Stimpy was also largely done because it was like an episodic TV cartoon budget. So they started with just like
right.
like paint a still image and put that on there. So yeah. And again, and like, you know, you'd think with animation, the point is you want it to be animated and to move. And then it's like, they're just going to show us the comic page, but like pan across it or something, then what are you adding?
Yeah. And so there's an Uzumaki anime that's supposed to be coming out and it's been like, I think the trailer first dropped like 2 years ago or something like that.
Yeah.
But it looks like a motion comic. It just looks like a motion comic.
It does. And I cannot stand motion comics.
No. I tried to watch the Watchmen one a bunch of years ago and it's unwatchable. Because it's one guy doing all the voices. And like, there are certain scenes when he's doing the voice of like Silk Spectre and you're like, don't man, don't do this voice. What are you doing?
What? I mean, yeah, I'm sure that was always Alan Moore's real dream to be like, okay, I can only make this as a comic now, but one day this will be turned into a really shitty looking animated film.
Yeah, with just a, like, I don't even know who that voice actor was. And sorry to that voice actor, whoever that man is. But it was just like, that's not what I want from these characters.
No.
But yeah, so another thing I think is... For those of you who haven't read any Junji Ito, and I highly recommend you read all of them. Like they're pretty quick reads because so much is just visual and there's text, but like it's a lot of just flipped pages. The type of horror that he kind of trades in, you have cosmic horror, which you know is more and more becoming something that people understand. Then there's specifically horror of like body horror, like disgusting growths or like, you know, gore. But then there's specifically the horror of the uncanny, which I find at this point in my life, like the most unsettling, where it's something that's just slightly off, you know, like an almost too realistic doll, you know, like the, you know, we talk about the Uncanny Valley quite a bit. But I think he somehow manages to capture the Uncanny Valley in a very unrealistic style of drawing. It's not like you ever go, well, that's a real person. Like you would never think that. It's clearly a drawing. And yet it's somehow certain images are so because they're more detailed than the other ones, they do hit that kind of uncanny valley, and you just kind of like, ugh, like it just kind of like puts you off. I'm thinking of like the supermodel or the,
About to bring up fashion model.
That's
yeah.
the one, fashion model. Thank you. Where there's a woman who just doesn't look like a person. Like it's just like,
And that's a funny one. And she's also a recurring character.
Mm-hmm.
He has, there's a handful of characters like fashion model, and Soichi is of course mm-hmm. a big one. I mean, he got his own book that came out last year.
Right.
And, but yeah, the fashion model honestly is this woman who, if you just saw a shot on your, like, of her on her own, you might think that he was a bad artist who had just like done a really poor job trying to draw a woman. But yeah, like that's a story that's basically about like, like a lot of these are about, you know, teens in Japan. Yeah. And it's like someone is looking through a magazine, like Vogue or something. And she's like, sees this one shot of just like this like really bizarre looking woman, and it unsettles her, and then ends up working on a student film like in school, and someone is like, hey, we decided to cast like you know, in this one role, this is one really interesting looking woman, and it turned out to be like the same woman that she had seen in like in that page in the magazine. And it's such a wild story. And they go to the woods, like a bunch of teens, like their film crew, and then this one really tall, strange looking woman. And then it turns out, oh yeah, they were correct to be scared of her because she looks weird. And then she just starts eating them.
Yeah.
She just like will like kind of seduce one person and then will just like rip his limbs off and just starts killing them all. And yeah. And the main recurring thing is, she's just like as much as, you know, it's gory and violent and upsetting. The main recurring thing through that story is just every image of her is just like the way, like the really really dark bags under her eyes. It's just like and the way he'll like reveal more detail, like when she opens her mouth and just be like, oh man, that there's a lot of really really sharp teeth in there. She like just the images of her are more unsettling than anything that actually happens in the story.
Yeah. And because if, yeah, just explaining what happens in the story, you're like, well, that doesn't sound that interesting. And that's the point of his books, I think. Like, very few of them have, like, compelling narratives. It's much more just this weird, like, childlike dream logic of, like, because sometimes he'll be like, 6 weeks later, I did this. And it's just like, like, it doesn't follow. Like, it just kind of goes, here's the next thing you need to know kind of thing. And I find that so, like, funny when you read a lot of his stuff. And not all of his stories are great. Like a lot of them are just like, oh, it was all right. But they all kind of have this weird, because all the characters, all the main characters are young people, they always have this kind of strange, like childlike outlook. And then it's like, and then this horrifying lady showed up and it's like, you're like, it just doesn't, because the similar thing is the woman in the window, I think is what it's called, or the person next door or something. There's multiple versions of it. But
oh, right.
This guy starts seeing this face in his next door neighbor's window. And then she just like, oh, like the more he sees her and then in the light, she's just an ugly woman. And that's the whole story. And it's a terrifying image. But that literally is the entire story is this woman looks weird.
Yeah.
Seems to be a thing he does a lot. The window next door. Excuse me, that's the name of it.
The window next door. I'm trying to. I always lose track of what stories are in what books because
Absolutely.
He has so many, like books that are story collections. Because I think so. Ito has a handful of like extended like novel length. Like books, we're it's like a single narrative. You know, Uzumaki is probably the most famous one. There's Tomie.
I think it's pronounced Tomie, but yes, essentially it's a series of adventures of this succubus woman.
Yeah, and then Gyo. Sort of.
Yeah, Gyo is great.
Yeah,
that was the first one I read.
I was gonna ask.
I love that one.
How did you get into Ito?
I'm trying to remember exactly I think I watched a video essay, as I often do. I believe it was Super Eye Patch Wolf's How Media Scare Us, which was like from 6 or 7 years ago or something like that. And in that, he talks about Junji Ito and like the, you know, I was kind of ripping him off with the page turn thing. But and that's when I was like, oh, this sounds really cool. And so I like got Uzumaki because that was like the one that everybody said. But then Gyo is shorter. And so I was like, I'll start with this one because I wasn't like that used to reading manga at the time.
Yeah, and that these one were the first. About... these were the first books that I actually, you know, read right to left and had to get used to it.
Yeah, I did. There was a small in college. There was one I took a comic books and literature class, which was a really interesting class. And we did a small section on manga, and we had to like go to the bookstore and pick up a manga. And I picked up one that I didn't realize was printed right to left, so I didn't even do it right, or left to right. I mean, I didn't even do it right. But yeah, so that was the first one that I read. And it, I mean, that one has, it's like an old Nazi plot that like with robotic legs that attach themselves to fish and sea life carcasses. And then they come up on the shore and eat people. It's, and then release the death stench that like turns people into zombies or kills them or something like that. It is such a strange story, but I'm like, that is, and he, like, I think fish are gross looking. That is like a revulsion that I have is fish. And so it's just these detailed drawings of ugly fish. And I'm just like, oh, this robot gets legs. Right to the heart of me.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, it's funny. I'm thinking back to how I got into them and then, you know, Gyo and all of that. My first one was definitely Uzumaki. Mm. I think it was a thing, you know, obviously, as we've talked about at length on here, you know, I like you like comics a lot. Mm-hmm. And you know, so much of manga is usually just like this very intimidating world to me, where I'll hear like, oh, a series is good, and then I'll look at it in a bookstore and I'll be like, there are 50 volumes of that.
Yeah, I'm trying to get into Berserk now, and I'm just like, oh, there's too much Berserk, I can't do it.
I know. And you know, the creator died before he finished it, and even just what he'd already completed was too much, and they're yeah. all in like these big like black leather bound books. I'm just like, yeah. Those take up a lot of space and cost yep. a lot of money. And sure. But yeah, I want to get into Berserk, but I kept hearing about Ito and hearing like, oh, you know, it's not an ongoing series. And I just saw some images and that were, you know, gnarly and weird, and I was just like, I think I'll dip my toe in. And yeah. And I started with Uzumaki, which of the long form stuff is still definitely my favorite.
I think it's his best just across the board. I think it's got everything you want from a, if you only read one Ito, it's, you better read that one.
Yeah. And I mean, I think cause like Uzumaki is fun because it is a story throughout that follows like a couple protagonists. But also it's so episodic that each chapter is basically just its own short story. So it's like you're like, it kind of threw me a bit when I read Gyo, which is way more of like a linear narrative.
Yeah.
And because I was used to Uzumaki, which is like almost like half story collection, half novel. But the very first story in Uzumaki, you know, the girl's dad who becomes obsessed with spirals and then turns himself into a spiral, you know, leading to the big reveal of the double splash page that is one of the best images Ito has ever drawn. That is like the perfect intro to him. Mm. And tells you immediately what you're getting into. And also so many of his stories basically have a similar approach to that, where it's some teens hanging out. One of them is like, I think there's a weird thing with my family. Want to come over and visit my family? And then, you know, I'm reminded of the one, one sec. I prepped for this.
Which I appreciate. The first guest to actually do any prep. Thank you very much for that.
Hey, of course. Well, it's the thing where, you know, we're talking about Junji Ito, and I have so many books of full of
so
short
many,
stories.
Yeah.
I want to be like, I need to be able to actually like find you know, the stories that I'm, you know, talking about. Oh, I found it. I will say it's in Shiver, which I think might be my favorite of his story collections. It's just like wall to wall bangers, but it's the story Honored Ancestors. And it's the one where the girl who's like lost her memory, but is going over to this guy's house who apparently she was engaged to. And she's just like hanging out there. It mostly seems to be about her memory. And then you have this thing where his dad is apparently sick. And but his dad wants to say hello. And then they're sitting in a room, and then like just down the hall, a door opens, and the dad, like laying on his back, kind of scurries out feet first, but you can't see the top of his head. And he's just like, oh, hello. And then eventually you get to the reveal where it's like, it turns out the memory thing, a really minor detail. She lost her memory because she had been so scared when she saw what the thing is that she just like developed amnesia. And it's this thing where every man in the family, eventually, like when they die, they like when they die, they cut off the top of their head, and then they stack all the tops of their heads with their brains together, and they fuse into this giant caterpillar thing that runs through the whole house. And then the guy that the amnesia girl was like engaged to, his dad dies. He's like, well, it's my turn, time to cut off the top of my dad's head and then climb in and fit this whole thing onto my head. And of course, you know, the reveal, like the full page of just like the giant weird caterpillar thing of like a million heads fused together is so unsettling and so weird. But that's basically what so many of these stories are. Just like someone goes over to someone's house and their family has some bizarre thing that is going on there.
Yeah. I think so much of that is like steeped in like Japanese polite society where people are just like, oh, okay, this is fine. And like, you know, cause I'm like in Uzumaki, there's that a couple issue or volumes, I think, or whatever, where there's the kid who turns into a snail.
That is the most unsettling one for me in the whole book.
It's so gross. And like, you know, a kid slowly turning into a snail and a huge giant snail, and the spiral shell is, you know, that ties into the spiral aspect of Uzumaki. And everyone just kind of like accepts it in class. They're just kind of like, oh, I guess he's a snail now or whatever. And he like climbs up the side of a building. And it's only like when it gets too, like way too far. And I think that's so funny. Like there's an aspect of reading these that are actually really funny because of that kind of thing where it's the reactions are both aghast, but also like, oh, hey, how are you doing? You know, weird dad who's a caterpillar head. Like you just kind of have to go with it. And
right.
I love that. I think it's like, that's something else that you would absolutely lose in adaptation if like somebody, because some of the ones like Yo Maybe or like I think like Hellstar Remina or Ramina, I don't know actually how you pronounce it, would be a really good one to do as a film. Right. But I don't know if you could westernize them because so much of it has to do with like Japanese culture and like modern society.
Yeah.
That I think you would lose part of that. And like the visuals alone just don't quite. I mean, they're beautiful and gross, but like, I don't think you would get the full impact of the stories if they were like westernized.
Yeah. Thinking about it now, and again, I want to be very clear. I'm not suggesting any of these get turned into movies because
I would, no, absolutely not.
Yeah. I fundamentally do think they work better in comic form. I am starting to wonder if any of them might like what might work best adapted for film. I'm kind of thinking maybe something about Soichi.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's a fun character. Okay, I will say for listeners who are not familiar with these, let me explain. Yes. Soichi. Yeah.
Get into the years long story of Soichi.
Well, because he's basically this recurring character who will just like pop up in various stories and then. And you can kind of figure out a bit of a timeline as well. And then this book came out last year. Almost every year, there's like a new Ito collection book. And it has like all of these like new stories about him. And there's this whole kind of timeline of his life and his family. And then there's also like in Haunted House, like a maybe future that's not confirmed as being like what happens when he grows up. But basically it's a thing where it's like these two Japanese teens, they go to visit their cousins for the summer. And they're, you know, their cousins are nice. They're visiting, they're having fun. And then one of their cousins, like, they're like, you know, in their extended family, like the youngest brother in this family, like their youngest cousin is this like 10-year-old boy named Soichi, who is just mopey and sulks in his room all the time. But, and just seems to hate everybody. And it's almost like a joke, but the thing with Soichi is he's always sucking on nails. He has a bunch of like metal nails in his mouth, and he's somehow able to like spit them super fast, so they'll like stab into things. And there's just these stories about, and it's funny because some of them are just like, ooh, impish little Soichi, he's going to play some tricks and do some things that are a little bit gross and mean. And people are like, Soichi, stop doing that. And then that's kind of the whole story. And then some of them get, so I'm thinking of the one with the cat and just the, you know, the shot of like the cat holding like that creature in its mouth. Yes. With all the eyes and legs. It bothers me so much. But some of them get so unsettling. And then you get the crazy thing where there's these stories that are, you don't even realize it's Soichi for a little bit because it's about, you know, some other teens and like this haunted house comes and opens in their town. And they're like, well, let's go check it out. It seems like a big deal. And people seem, you know, to be pretty scared of it. And then you realize the guy who runs it is grown up Soichi, who still has nails in his mouth, and then has basically all of those other cousins and family members, he has basically like imprisoned them in his haunted house and tortured them for years. And then he has this son who is this like feral, like cannibalistic child who like is locked in a cage. And his wife is this monstrous woman who looks like the fashion model, but I'm not sure it is definitively. Oh,
yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah. Is Soichi married to the fashion model?
Who at the end of that like eats his head, and then it turns out like, well, maybe that didn't actually happen, and that's not the future of Soichi. But just this thing about like, because those stories are a bit more about like humans, and so much of it is just about like, what's Soichi up to in his room? Like, I could see that there's a reality where that is an okay movie.
Yeah. And just
weird... Our Summer with Soichi.
Yeah. I could see that. And because that one is so much, like you said, it's humans. It's like this weird guy. I could see any movie about a weird guy like right. that, you know, who chews on nails. It actually, because I never read these in any kind of order, and it took me a really long time to realize that he wasn't just reusing a name, that was literally supposed to be the same character. And it, because, you know, I read stuff and I was like, oh yeah, the nail thing, I remember that. And then it was sort of just like, wait, I thought he was a kid. Like, it just like so constantly. And by the way, a lot of people have been asking if Fuichi from Fashion Model, is she Soichi's wife? So,
well, okay.
It's not just you. She might be.
It's one of the great questions of our time. I think
in Smashed.
Yep. The Haunted House one is in Smashed, but because then isn't it a thing where, oh yeah, yeah, here's Smashed also has, oh God, it's the, just like, look at that thing.
Yeah. I've seen, like, there's a t-shirt that has that image on it that I've seen that I'm like, I can't have that.
No.
Ito has such an interesting thing with cats because he like has written a whole like little short thing about how much he loves cats, but how much he's afraid of them. And like he draws evil cat eyes like better than like I have cats and I'm like, am I supposed to be scared of my cats?
I know.
Because of the way he draws them.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, the weird thing is like I'm looking through in the book Smashed, which came out like a few years ago.
Yeah.
There's the haunted house stories, which are theoretically about grown-up Soichi. And then I think the story after that is set back in the past, and it's about Soichi's cousin who like came to visit for the summer. And now, and like her extended family is like missing, and she's like looking for them. And it seems, and that's when you start, you know, you start to wonder, like, did Soichi, who like in some stories, again, just seems like an impish little troublemaker, actually, is he like a like psychopath who basically like tortured and like killed some of his family? I don't know. They're weird. And there are so many of these. And when these books come out, I'm just like, I'm never sure. Is this just like all the stories he made in the last year? Are these collected from a number of years? It's really not clear, but there's just a lot of these. And every time, about once a year, I'll go into my local comic shop and I'll just see on the new releases wall an Ito book, and I'll be like, well, I'm gonna pick it up and see what weird shit he's got for me now.
Yeah. My wife always knows what to get me for my birthday, because she's just like, just don't buy Jinji Ito and I'll just buy whatever the new one is. I'm like, okay, great. That sounds like a perfect plan.
Terrific. Well, okay. I've got to ask now.
Please.
Do you have favorite stories?
I do. I made a list. So besides like Uzumaki is like obviously a work of art, and some of the more recent, like longer, I don't know if you've read these, but like Black Paradox and Censor. Have you read those ones?
I haven't read Black Paradox. I did recently read Censor.
Censor is really interesting with like, I don't know if it quite works for me, but like the idea of like, that one's about hair being like angelic in some fashion, and like harnessing the evil power of hair can like turn you into the black god of whatever. And it's very strange. Black Paradox is about a group of kids who have made a pact to unalive themselves, but then they can't. And it's like, it's a weird, like paranormal, not quite detective story, but like all four of these weird people who are mad at the life that they have, like go and see weird paranormal stuff. It's a very strange book, I would say.
Because anyway, his others are so normal.
That's a great point. But that one, like, you never see like that kind of extended amount of, like it's a dark, I'm not like, if the premise alone wasn't enough, like it's a dark thing. There's a lot of stuff in there about like doppelgangers and like, just it's a very unsettling, read that I highly recommend.
I think my
favorite across the board, of shorts has got to be the Enigma of Amagara Fault, which is in the back of Gyo, but you can also, I think, read it individually, which is, that might be the reason, like someone described that to me, and that was the reason I was like, wait, who is this guy? And that's when I did research into like, you know, and videos and stuff like that, because, again, I'll spoil the story, but it won't actually spoil the sensation of reading it. An earthquake has caused a sheer mountain cliff to slide off, and there are all these weird like divots and crevices in the cliffside, and people start realizing that they're human shaped. And then specific people start realizing that that hole that is shaped like a person is shaped like them, and they are preternaturally drawn to their hole, and then they climb into it and they just kind of get sucked into the mountain. And it's like this one guy is like just terrified that he's like, what am I going to find on the other side, you know, in the mountain and all this stuff. And people just do it. And then the very last couple pages is people have dug through the other side of the mountain and found the other side of the hole, and they're not human shaped. They're like weird, you know, like little, just basically cracks or little like, water, breakages. And then they look inside and there are people who have been like squished to death in there. And it's just like the idea of not, of like starting out human being like, I have to see what this is. And then the knowledge is now you're not a human anymore. You're this weird creature. That just is like so succinct. And it's maybe what, like 10 pages, something like that. Like it's perfect. I think it's a perfect horror story.
It is. Yeah. I can't argue with that. It's just, I mean,
so there.
It is. I was just this morning, I was, you know, when prepping for this, I was flipping back through, sticking Post-its in these books to label some of my favorites. And I was going back through that story, and I'm just like, this might objectively be the best one.
Mm-hmm.
It's It's one. It's built on a really strange idea that no other human would ever think of. It has humans developing some kind of obsession, which is a real recurring thing through these stories, where someone's just like, "I have to see the thing," or "I need to. I'm going to murder you to get that used record with this song on it because I'm obsessed with it." There's very often some kind of weird obsession. And then the final page is this like great, hyper detailed, horrifying reveal. And it's like, it's everything you want in a Junji Ito story. You could hand that to someone, you know, kind of like the first chapter of Uzumaki, and be like, here's his entire deal in like 10 pages.
Yeah. Because the whole thing with Uzumaki is it starts because a guy in town, which is that the character's dad that you mentioned earlier, becomes obsessed with the shape of spiral, and then he wants everything to be a spiral, including himself. And then that grows to the entire town, everybody else in it. And then, like, it just becomes a cosmic nightmare at the end. And, like, you know, I was really getting into cosmic horror 5 or 6 years ago, and, you know, read Lovecraft, which is not the best written stuff ever, but I think the ideas are really good. But it's people iterating on those cosmic horror ideas, and Ito's maybe one of the best out there. That really gets me like jazzed about like where horror can go, because like there's only so many, I mean, I love a good like gothic horror werewolf story or something like that, but like there's only so many times you can watch that and not feel I've seen this before. Like,
right.
It's actually kind of cozy to watch these kind of movies where like, I'm never cozy reading a Junji Ito story. And I like that. I like that aspect of it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, part of what I think is so fun about Uzumaki is it literally seems like as if like as a challenge to himself, he just picked a random thing.
Right.
Like he went to the beach and was just like, I'm just going to close my eyes and, you know, move my finger around and whatever I'm pointing at, I'm going to write an entire book of stories about that one thing. And he pointed it at like, I don't know, a little shell's or a little snail's shell. And it's like a spiral. Great. I'm gonna take the idea of scary stories about a shape and follow that as far as it can possibly go. And it turned into this big old book where you get everything from, oh yeah, a man is going to like fit himself inside like a circular basin and contort his whole body into a spiral. And then you'll get a story where kids in school start slowly mutating into snails because they have spiral shells. And then you get this whole like body horror thing of then they're like, their eyes extend out on stalks and they're also just slimy now.
Mm-hmm.
And then that goes further because then the other kids in school decide to start eating them. And so you get this like, so yeah, the snail kids look weird and they creep me out. And then you get the other kids deciding to eat them and basically become cannibals. And I'm just like, you got all of this out of just being like, what if I wrote a book about a spiral?
Yeah, it's that's a fun shape. Let's do that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They're all so interesting. I was trying to think of some of my favorites. I mean, one, like, if you look at my copy of Shiver here, you will see more.
Oh, yeah, that's a lot of tabs.
Yeah, more tabs than any of the other books. I realized, like, oh, wait, this one really is. It's like, it's almost like a greatest hits collection looking at the table of contents. And this is the one that introduces the fashion model. Fashion model is in this book as well, but it has one. And look, if anyone has even just like encountered Junji Ito stuff online, it contains a page that you've probably seen because it is truly one of, I think, the grossest things anyone has ever drawn. This is a story called Greased.
Oh. That's the closest I've gotten reading any of his stuff to just being like, I can't read this anymore. Like, it's so disgusting.
Yes. Yeah. And it's about these two kids, a girl and her younger brother, who I believe their dad owns. Their dad owns a barbecue restaurant and they live in the apartment above it. And because of all the cooking, grease fumes permeate their apartment and everything just becomes coated with grease. And then in a classic Junji Ito fashion, her younger brother develops a weird obsession with this grease and just wants to become greasier and greasier, and starts getting more and more pimples on his face.
Ugh.
And then it just escalates. And just the way that Ito just will just draw just like coats all of the walls and floors in the pictures with just this kind of like just this black ink that just looks greasy. It just gets grosser and grosser. And yeah, anyway, builds to this spectacular page where the girl's younger brother basically holds her down and climbs over her and squeezes his hands against his face, which is coated in a million pimples, as just like streams and streams of pus pour down onto her face.
In just so much detail. It's one of the largest images in the entire story. It's so gross.
It is. I also realize as I'm describing this, I'm imagining if like my parents heard me saying this and they'd just be like, Patrick, what the fuck is wrong with you? Why?
Why are you doing this to yourself?
Why? What you're describing sounds like the least appealing thing one could possibly read. And I'm just like, I don't know, man. There's something about it. Also in this book, some other faves. It has Honored Ancestors, the one I mentioned before. You know, about the caterpillar trail of heads. It's got The Long Dream.
The Long Dream is really interesting. Yeah.
And basically just a thing where a guy will like go to sleep and even though he sleeps for a normal night's sleep, somehow like his head, like he'll be like dreaming for years and he starts like aging really rapidly, which of course leads to weird, you know, images of his body as he kind of decays while being alive. But it also has, I think, going really far away from body horror, a story that I think is one of the best Ito stories, Hanging Blimp.
Yeah, that's another. Yeah, go ahead.
And I mean, this is just one where I'm just like, no other human would think of this idea because it is like, how would you explain this one?
Somehow out of nowhere, most of his stories start like that. Somehow out of nowhere, people start seeing giant balloons in the sky that are their own faces with horrible rictus grins on them. And hanging from these balloons are strings. Oh, wait, they're not actually strings. They're nooses. And they chase the people down and find their own humans and then choke them and like pick them up and then they're dead. And so there's just human beings hanging from the sky with the giant, horrifying, smiling image of those people's faces like above them. And like, no matter what you do, you can't run away from them. Like, that is clearly a nightmare he had about or something like that. And also, like, it's a weird, like, have you ever thought about how scary your own face is? Like, when I was a little kid, this is a stupid story. When I was a little kid, I used to go into our bathroom and shut the lights off and then get my face as close to the mirror as possible and make some weird contorted face and then flick the lights back on and then try to see if I could scare myself. It's stupid. Dumb stuff you do when you're a kid. But, like, if you spend enough time looking in the mirror, sometimes your own face can scare you. And like, I feel like that is something that very few people, I mean, the doppelganger fear is literally someone looks like me and that's scary, but literally it's you that is scary. And like, that's, you almost never see something like that. I love that story. That's a great one.
It's so good. And I'm thinking about the way it progresses actually, where it starts off just seeming like there's like a string of suicides like in Tokyo of people hanging themselves. Mm-hmm. And then you get like the reveal of like the main character, who I believe is a teen girl, just
strange,
like sees like at night just sees her face in the sky and then slowly starts to realize like what is going on. And it's such a weird image because you've got like this giant head in the sky and then its neck just extends down into just like basically a rope. And then you get to the point where just like a swarm of giant heads are flying through like Tokyo, just trying to snatch up people and hang them. And you have people like hiding for safety in their apartments while their giant heads are just like floating outside the window, like waiting for them, being like, you got to come out for groceries at some point. It's genuinely like one of the most bizarre things I've ever read. It's also very unsettling. And it's like, it's one of the perfect things where I'm just like, yeah, no one else is going to think of this. Did you think of this?
We should also say, like, Junji Ito is not like a scary guy. Like, if you've ever seen an interview with him, he's a very like, he carries himself very kind of like small. Like, he seems like a very small figure. He's got glasses. He kind of just like smiles and stuff. And there's like a video, I forget who did it, where it's like showing Junji Ito scary videos, and like he just sits and watches them and kind of goes, huh, well, that's scary. And it's just like, he's so nonchalant about being terrified. And some of these videos are like legitimately creepy or weird or something like that. And to think that all of that comes from I think he was a dental student or something like that, or a medical student beforehand, and just decided, I'm going to draw terrifying pictures for a living. And he's amazing at it. Like, I am kind of fascinated by the idea of horror creators where they're like super cool guys. Like, Steve Niles is another good example, who did like 30 Days of Night. Like, he's a horror comic author, and he's just like a cool guy. He's just like, hey man, what's going on? Like, I met him a couple times. He's cool. But like, you would never think, I'm going to draw and write a terrifying story about vampires or something like that. Like, I love that you don't know people kind of thing, like what's in their brain kind of thing. The real scary people are the people who seem normal.
Exactly. There you go. I mean, it's a thing, like I have no statistic for this, but just anecdotally, a thing I've always heard is that people who primarily work in horror, whether like filmmakers, authors, or whatever, tend to be pretty chill. While like, filmmakers who make just like drama movies that are not scary at all can be the biggest monsters of them all.
Yeah.
And so just, I don't
know. So many. Yeah.
Maybe they're just like exercising all of their demons through their work, and then are very, you know, nice and well-adjusted and friendly, outside of their work.
Yeah. I think that's so funny. Cause horror people are so just delightful. If you know, and horror fans too. Like, I think a lot of normies, let's call them normies, when they think about the people who make horror movies, they probably go like, oh, you know, like the Crypt Keeper. They assume the Crypt Keeper is making these movies, right, or something like that. And then it's like, no, just like David Cronenberg is just like a polite Canadian guy. And like, you know, George Romero is just like salt of the earth guy from Pittsburgh. Like, it's just, it's great.
Stephen King just hanging out there in Maine, writing books about Maine.
Oh, go back 2 episodes ago. We did a whole episode about Stephen King adaptations. If you're interested in Stephen King, again, listeners, and also Patrick, if you feel like listening to it,
there's a lot to cover.
Another one I want to shout out before we wrap it up. It's called The Thing That Drifted Ashore, which is literally just about a huge giant, again, slugs. He makes a lot of slugs. I think it might be in the collection called Slugs.
No, wait. I haven't read this one, but okay, I've heard, is it in the Slug Girl book?
It's in the Slug Girl book, yeah.
Which is one of the, like, I don't know why I haven't picked that up.
It's another like weird sea life thing. It's actually kind of similar to Enigma of Amagara Fault and some other ones. He kind of has this thing where like a thing will appear and people don't know what to do about it. And then it turns out that it's like, it's because a lot of his are, you know, very personal, like one person seeing something horrifying or something like that. But the ones that I find really interesting, like Hellstar Romina too, is where it's just like a planet with an eyeball is coming toward us. What are we going to do? And like the entire planet has to kind of figure out what's going on and try to stop it and stuff. He's got this like thread of inevitability and doom in most of his books, and like, and that one, so I won't spoil that one because you haven't read it, but like The Thing That Drifted Ashore, like it sounds like it's a Lovecraft story. Like, it's just like, what is this? And, it's suitably horrifying. Definitely read that one if you haven't. I mean, cause there's, he's written, I think in total, he's written 121 stories of varying lengths. And that's also including, like, you know, Uzumaki is counted as one story in this list.
Yeah. And like, is Tomie, there is like one story.
Yeah. It's, yeah, it's 1.1 through 1.21 is Tomie.
Okay. Yeah. That's, I only read that for the first time last year. And I enjoyed it like I do all his stuff, but it's honestly not one of my favorites.
Mine either. Yeah.
I think it's also maybe his largest book. It's a big book, and it's, I mean, it's kind of one thing, and then, you know, like repeated a lot. It's like, okay, there's a very pretty girl, and she'll, you know, she'll date some guy and he'll become obsessed with her, and then she'll be mean or something, and then he'll like get mad and murder her, and then she'll come back. And yeah, that's basically it.
That's the whole bit. I feel like because I think the first like four or five like chapters of that book are the same string of guys or something like that.
Yeah.
And so you kind of, and then afterwards he kept going back and writing like one-offs. And I think that's just a collection of like 15 or 20 years worth of Tomie stories. And like, I'm like, I get it. You know, they had already made a couple of Tomie movies in Japan, which I've never seen, but like, I think, I don't know. Like, it's a very strange concept where your villain is just, I dare you to kill me. Oh, you did? Ha ha. You know, it's just I think that doesn't work all that often. Like, you can't do it that many times.
I honestly think, because that kind of thing about like, oh, there's a pretty girl who's also like mean or in some way. I kind of think he's done a bit better or more interestingly in other just like self-contained stories. Like there's the one about the girl who like the guy dates her, and then with her hair or something, like when he's asleep, puts a little band around his neck. And then it basically, she basically cuts his head off, but he's alive. And then just kind of taunts him like, ooh, you're gonna, like, if you don't let go of your head and keep holding it on, then your head's gonna fall off. And then she's like, oops, watch, your hands are busy holding your head up there. I'm gonna slip like a live bug in the gap between your head and your body. And it's like, that is one that is like, I feel like you know, it, again, it's just about like a pretty girl who turns out to be mean. But it does, it goes to really weird places, and just like, and then it starts like freaking me out being like, oh God, what would I do if my head had been severed from my body, but I was still alive and I had to hold it on, but then I couldn't use my hands at all because they're busy holding my head on.
That is, again, that's something that is like little kid logic.
Yeah.
Where like, you know, because there's that story that all little kids heard about the girl with the ribbon around her neck and takes it off and then her head falls off. And it's like, ah, it's one of those. But like, we know as grown-up people that if she were to have severed his spinal cord, he couldn't use his arms. Like, we know that. And yet,
but he's holding his head on tightly enough that they're still touching.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
it's like
it's
when
science.
Right. It's like starting a, like hot wiring a car. Like you can do that
right
with your own head. Yeah, that story, like there's so many of those type of stories. You're absolutely right. Where like, there's just a guy who thinks everything's fine. And then somebody he meets, it's usually a girl. So it's like when Ito's main characters are young girls, it's always about like older men, tormenting her in some fashion. And when it's the main characters are boys, it's that a cute girl is being shitty and it's and evil and whatever, and there's nothing you can do about it. There's a weird, like I said, a weird inevitability to his stuff, and like there's no, the twist is never, and then it was fine. Like it's always like, no, it's just as bad as you think it's gonna be, and actually it's probably worse. And like you're just looking at a tunnel and just like, it's coming. And it's, I mean, like he could do an entire story that is literally just a thing walking toward the camera of the page. And that would be the scariest thing ever, because like, that's what most of his stories are.
Exactly. And I think what's fun about the short story collections is that he wastes no time, like getting to the thing. And so you get your big, so basically it's like every 20 pages of the book, you get this payoff to like this, and this big reveal of like, whatever the weird thing in the house is, are, I'm reminded of like, and again, a lot of these things I think would not sustain like a novel, you know, like a Marionette Mansion.
Yep.
Where as if he just thought, well, you know what's weird? Marionettes. What if a person was so obsessed with puppets that they built a house and hired puppeteers to live up in the rafters and you could live as a marionette, and then they have this whole family there that where they don't touch the ground, they just have people above them puppeteering them, and it's so strange. But but you know, he finds this thing that is like, it really seems like a lot of these are basically like he zeroes in on unsettling image and then like works back from there to be like, okay, how do we justify this happening and how can someone find out about it?
There's another one like that like it could be shorter, honestly, because it is just the concept, which is called the human chair, where that's literally a girl's, is it a girl? I forget. It's either a girl or a guy, but who sits in like a Barca lounger type big giant chair. And then at the end of it, finds out that there's a person in the chair that, so he's just, they've just been sitting on a person. And the big reveal is like, they've unzipped the back of the chair and there's like a human cutout of where they go. And it's horrifying, but like, that's not a story. Like that is literally just a concept. Right.
One that I was just, this must be great to listen to for people who haven't read any of these, because we're just being like,
I hope people are like, I need to look at all of these stories because I don't know what you're talking about.
Like the last one that I will mention is, again, one that would not sustain a longer narrative because it's mostly a buildup to just, I think, like the final page, which is an amazing double page splash. I think this one is this the one in, it's in Fragments of Horror.
Mm-hmm.
The story is called, one sec, let me get the actual title here. It's called Dissection Chan.
I don't remember this one. I'm sure when you describe it, I will.
It's about a weird girl. It starts when she's a kid and kind of goes up through at least when, I think when she's maybe in college. She's basically, she discovers an obsession with dissecting things. And then she wants to be dissected herself.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And then basically you have this thing where it turns out what she'll do is she'll like, usually like, you know, meet boys or whatever and who are interested in her. And then they'll be like, hey, you know what I'm into? I like it when you you cut open my abdomen and then just put things inside me. And then eventually, like the payoff to this all is she's dead, and people at the morgue do an autopsy on her, and they cut open her body, and you get this double splash page of just her insides. Where, let me just describe a little bit of this because it is genuinely, I think, one of the strangest images I've ever seen in a comic. And it's so weird. Okay, so you know, here's the page.
Yeah. Oh,
so they dissect her, and inside her body there's like you know, a lot of eyeballs of varying sizes, just spirals of organs. You got a really big frog that has fused to a mouse and to a bat, and then just various like hairy tendrils going off of all of them. There are weird pustules all over everything. It's gross as hell.
Yeah.
And which is funny because one of the speech bubbles here is the doctor proclaiming, this isn't in our gross anatomy text. And that's basically it. That's the end. It's just, you know, just the reveal of all her life, this woman just put stuff inside her body, and then here's all the stuff that was there.
She finally died, and all this shit, like, it's, yeah, it is insane. It's, again, who thinks of this stuff? Like, what if there was a bat fused to a frog and whatever you said in somebody's, oh, a mouse inside somebody's abdomen? That's living, apparently.
Yep. I will say the final panel of the story is just a close up of her dead body with a slight smile on its face as all of the surgeons are like horrified.
Yeah.
It's great.
Oh, it's great. It is great. If any of these stories sound interesting to you, I believe it's Viz Media here in the United States has put out huge compendiums of all of them. I think you can find a lot of them on in digital formats as well, but
you really want to turn that page.
It's the page turn. I don't think you get the same thing with a tap or, you know, like a swipe of a thing. You do need the tactile thing. I agree. Patrick, thank you so much for being here and talking about the scariest and grossest things ever.
Kyle, thank you so much for having me. It has been such a pleasure.
Absolutely. Well, I would on air invite you to come back anytime you would like. If you have something you want to plug, please do that.
Please come back.
We can talk about anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Seriously, I'll come back anytime. I mean, look, clearly I feel like there's a lot more in like just the comics world that we could spend hours on.
Yeah, I do want it because the new Batman movie that will eventually come out is going to introduce live action Damian Wayne. And I want to talk to you about that. I think that would be great. So we'll talk about that at another time. For the folks who maybe don't follow your work, how can people watch and or listen to you on the internet?
Well, I make videos that are mostly about movies. You know, I've got a show, long form video essays that you can watch on YouTube or the platform Nebula.
And there are Nebula exclusive things that you made. The aforementioned Christmas special is Nebula exclusive.
Exactly. Look, it's late January. This will be out in February.
Yes.
I'm sure what you really want right now is Christmas stuff. But maybe save it just for December. We mentioned it earlier. We recently came out this past December, produced an hour-long 60s-style musical Christmas special that is also a video essay about Star Wars. I'm very happy with it, and I think it's a lot of fun. But yeah, we got a lot of stuff there. I talk too much on the internet, but usually it's heavily scripted, and so more articulate and eloquent than this. So yeah, that's what I'm up to.
I meant to say this earlier when we were talking about that special. My favorite thing that you do in a lot of your videos is like the let's stop what's going on and like you and either your intern or like the producer, you'll be like, oh boy, I'm really in the weeds with this one. I just love that. Any conceit where it's like, this isn't going well at all. I love that. It makes me laugh every time.
Well, it makes us laugh as well. So that's why we keep doing it.
Great. You can, we have a video coming out soon that I wrote and hosted if you are into listening to me talk some more, which is all about the history of Doctor Who regenerations and how getting bent out of shape about any one of them is a fool's errand because they've never been normal. Patrick is also on Letterboxd, I believe. Yeah, you're on Letterboxd. I follow you on Letterboxd. Please follow me on Letterboxd, Kyle_Anderson, and you can follow Patrick. I believe it's just Patrick.
I'm Patrick H. Willems everywhere.
Everywhere. And that's not Williams, friends. It's Willems, like Willem Dafoe, but with an S at the end.
Exactly. Like we all love Willem Dafoe. Imagine a lot of him, like more than one, and that's me.
Yeah. You know what? That's a great explanation. Put that on your card.
I really should.
Like many Willem Dafoes. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you again, Patrick, for joining me. I've been Kyle Anderson. Join me again next time on Laser Focus when my guest will be a different person. Bye-bye. Laser Focus is a production of Nerdist Industries and Legendary Digital Networks. It was produced, edited, and hosted by me, Kyle Anderson. For more, visit Nerdist.com.